by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest smack dab in the middle of it. Rest smack dab in the middle. We are rest smack dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host.
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Okay, Charlotte, how you doing up there in Missouri, okay?
Yeah, having a great holiday. Thank you.
We've got one of the finest guests with us this evening. Dana Dunford is his name. He's out of Canada, and he has really made an ultimate sacrifice several times in doing surveys up and down the British Columbia coast. And we're going to bring him on and let him explain what he's been doing a little bit about himself. Welcome to our program, Dana Dunford.
Thank you, George. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello. Yeah, okay. Dana, tell our listening audience a little bit about your background and what you've been doing since the Fukushima event in Japan.
Sure. I've got a unique background on the ocean and in the ocean. I worked 14 years as a commercial diver, and I ran over a dozen commercial dive operations on the ocean, usually 6 hours a day. I was injured after 128 days straight, 6 hours a day on the ocean floor, and it took me almost 15 years to get out of my hospital bed. I crowdfunded an operation and then headed out and done a survey on the coastline. But before all of that, I'd grown up on the ocean. I come from a little community, still has no automobiles. And so we lived many generations in that little tiny community. And so I'm very tuned into the ocean anyway, and I covered it ever since I was a child. I grew up on a strict diet of National Geographic's and great ocean explorers. And so I saw my future as ocean and ocean only. And then I got injured after many, many years, decades on the ocean. And I had done every industry in both oceans and then every industry underwater. And so I come at it from a unique perspective. But I also had a big passion for nuclear. And so I have over 7,000 lectures accumulated over the last decade, say, and that's part of me. That's who I am, is I really understand the nuclear industry at this stage, of course, but I was always so fascinated with both of these, and I had no idea that these two would conflict in such a dramatic way as what we see going on. And so what I done was I crowdfunded an operation a year and a half ago, and we done 5 expeditions on the coastline of British Columbia. We covered 15,000 miles in a total of 260 days, and one of the trips were 5 months before I made it back home. And so what I done was I done the tidal zones, the nursery of the ocean, and the nursery of the ocean itself is well explored and well categorized through institutions right around North America. And so we have a model to work with. We know that on the coastline of British Columbia, Canada in particular, we have 5,600 what they call residential species, but some parts of British Columbia have, like Barkley Sound, would have another 1,800 species. But these are considered the residential. There's another 4.2 million species in the Pacific Ocean, but they can't get a lock on the shoreline because every millimeter was jostling with that 5,600 species, basically. And now if you were to go down and plow in a healthy coastline, and those 5,600 species that dominate those areas for millenniums through genetic superior selection would reclaim those areas. In other words, if you plowed in a mile of the coastline, the ocean would recede it, but also the creatures deeper in both sides would fill up that gap in a very short order, because that is the prime breeding ground for the entire ocean, is the tidal zones. Now, on top of that, in those tidal zones amongst the 6,000 algae, the kelps, there's around 6,500 invertebrates that are like small shrimp. that are also indigenous to British Columbia, considered the residential species. And so we surveyed the entire coastline nonstop, and the last expedition we covered every 20 miles of the open west coast. I done that by myself. And so now it's definitive. When we look at the data, the coastline was stripped, and the 4.2 million other species didn't recede that coastline. And now the coastline of British Columbia is kept warm all year long by the warm waters from Japan. That's a direct path, of course, and that the corrosion current. So why the scientists were looking at tuna and large mammals, not that you shouldn't, but why they were, it struck me as odd that nobody went in and studied the most vulnerable part of the ocean ecosystem itself, which was the tidal zones, the most visible, highly well known. And if there was going to be a cause and effect, it would show up right there. We never dreamt for a second that it would be a complete and extinction event. As we went down the coastline, there was no birds. Every day I would go ashore on these islands, there were six islands. And what I discovered as I went into the forest and explored a little bit was that there was no spider webs, and that the ones I did see were deformed, and that there was no birds. It was silent. And we stayed on one island for 8 days, me and a friend of mine on another expedition. And we left our tent open the whole time. The tent didn't fill up with insects or something like that. We left our food on the table on purpose, and the flies didn't show up or gather around it. And so by the time we got through 8 days in that one spot, and this was totally way up the west coast of Canada, right in the unknown where there's no one around. There was no life. This was striking, of course. And then there was one more expedition after that one where we done the whole west coast. And so now I'm producing a documentary so that maybe, just maybe, we can try to find a way forward for the planet. We cannot save the Pacific Ocean. And I know this sounds alarming, and I know it sounds salacious. I know it sounds fear-mongering even, but it's impossible to have a conversation about something so dramatic without those connotations. And George, as you know, of course, and you've had so many speakers on the stage up in Texas, and you've worked so hard to try to be lucid and only come up with the best data available for everybody, and you've never stopped, obviously. And it's people like yourself and everybody else that have put their back to the wall because they actually understand the nuances and the minutiae of the minutiae of the minutiae of the details, because that is the golden key to understanding what we're up against. And we can't ignore it any longer because the birds have disappeared, the whales and mammals that are all dying in mass are emaciated. And that was because the phytoplankton, the basis of the food chain, carbon sequestering, the oxygen chain was wiped out fairly quickly. And so I know this is very worrying to people that are not quite familiar with the kind of narrative that I'm using. But I think that knowledge and understanding and facing up to the crisis is the only way forward. Pretending it's not this or not that is not conducive of solutions. You won't get anywhere. You can't inspire people or generations to get busy, you know. And so I always want people to take that into context when I'm talking, to think about it as a meteorite coming at this planet under normal circumstances. That would be very visible. We could see that as very tangible. That would generate a lot of social media conversations about how are we going to stop it, what are we going to do. But we would expect as a collective worldwide, if we faced an event like that, that we would take – so North America does 4,300 peer-reviewed studies are published every day. We would expect to use that horsepower to come up with solutions for that meteorite. Why would we not, you know? And because of the nuclear industry stranglehold upon communities, and there's a lot of people employed. There's a million corporations dependent upon the nuclear industry. The chunk of the military's budget towards nuclear now is going to be $1 trillion. It invades every aspect of our life, but through misrepresentation and through indoctrination for the last 70 years to think that it's benign or innocuous or harmless, when we have terrorist laws for a reason, we have nuclear waste sites for a reason, we don't put bananas and potato chips and sunshine in those places. And so this is where the confusion goes when I'm talking. People can't relate to what I'm saying because they're so confused. And so I always throw that out there that we're not worried about a terrorist getting a bunch of bananas and detonating it. We're worried about them getting a gram of, say, uranium. And a gram, for anybody that doesn't understand, is is around 400 train car loads of coal is processed, heavily processed and chemically treated, a massive amount of water to get a gram of uranium.
Right.
Now, that gram is a million watts. That's a million watts. And in the context of that, that's 3,000 watt heater. Consider anybody that's familiar with a 3,000 watt heater. It's a big, powerful heater. It can run 333 of those, a single gram, something the size of a dime. So it is extraordinary. It is phenomenal. But in that single gram is enough atoms distributed evenly to give every human and every animal on the planet cancer. And hence the problem, right? Go ahead, George.
Right. You know, we've interviewed Helen Caldicott, and she made emphasis on, because radiation is not that perceptible. See, you don't, it's not like a fire burning your hand or something. And because of that characteristic, it can undermine life, but not, you know what I mean? It's not that, evident.
You can't see it, smell it, hear it, taste
right.
it.
And that's what's so dangerous of it. And that's exactly what you were saying just a few minutes ago.
Right. And I didn't follow up. And I normally would throw in that sentence where you can't see it, hear it, smell it, pick it up, or throw rocks at it.
Sure.
Per se. You can't scare it away, in other words.
Right.
You can't contain it. That's why we're worried about a dirty bomb, per se, in terrorist drills through in our countries.
Sure.
Is that a terrorist might get a gram of this. Now, in context, a nuclear explosion is just several pounds. You know, like say the traditional Nagasaki Hiroshima type references that we hear in context of accidents.
Right.
And so each of the reactors in Japan had 5 million pounds. They had 3,450 assemblies. Each assembly has 80 rods. Each rod is around 12 feet long and weighs about 18 pounds. And so that's around 5 million pounds per cycle. And the cycle is about 2 years. Now, so the six reactors, that should be 30 million pounds in every two years, basically, if they're running cycles in the air. That's why they built them that way. That's why they can hold 3,450 assemblies. But that's 30 million pounds. But a pound of this stuff, folks, to put it in the context, if you had a theater with 1,500 people and you had a pound up on the stage, everybody in the front row is dead in a minute, and the entire theater, 1,500 people, is dead in 20 minutes or less. Now, you can have a dropout bottom, all the people fall down into an endless hole, and you can march people in there every 20 minutes till everybody's exterminated on the planet and then get rid of all the animals with a pound of this stuff. That's why it's so ferocious. That's why it's so scary. That's why we spend billions and billions and billions of dollars on security, because it's actually not like a banana or a potato chip. It's actually really scary stuff. And once you went through the chain reaction, it's no longer like, so originally they took the uranium. Uranium's not the natural stuff is not measured by Becquerel's atomic decays. It's measured by milligrams. But when they refine it now, it puts out Becquerel's, which is atomic decays, which is what we're talking about. And when they put it through a chain reaction, it's now 2 million times worse. And so we changed every single property imaginable by putting it through a chain reaction. We do that by adding an extra electron onto an atom. And so it's another isotope being added into an atom. And now the atom has a new atomic weight. So if we took a banana, it has potassium 40. That is stuff that we were acclimated to through millenniums. And everything on this planet lives in harmony with it. It's not radiation. It's just an emitter. But it's not really – it's something that the whole universe is full of.
Yes.
But the stuff, we take it and we create it with all the isotopes we talk about are created from uranium. So when people hear about iodine, that's not the iodine you get in your kelp or salt or something like that. This is man-made, but it works the same way as iodine. So it finds your way into the body the same way iodine does. So it acts like iodine, in other words, is how I'm trying to say to people. And that is why they call it the name they do. But it also has the same kind of a makeup as it, exactly, in many senses, because the sun creates the same elements, but we take that and we destroy it by adding extra electrons onto it. And so now it has a new atomic number. Now it's classified as a dirty bomb. Every single one of them are completely different, and we don't know the long-term impacts, but they say there's 10 half-lives, for instance, to these isotopes. So if an isotope is going to last 30 years, it starts breaking down in what they call half-lives to 50%, but the other 50% turns to another isotope. And then it breaks down 30 years later, and that was 25% of the original isotope, 50% has changed again. The other 25 is another. So this gets really confusing. But when it comes to adding an extra electron, like a chain reaction, that actually never stops. But what they say is that by the time it got 10 half-lives, then it's considered okay to be in a, released into the environment. But when you look at the literature, they say it's not, that there is no known knowns about it, where it is safe because it has an extra atomic weight. But what that means to me and everybody else in a short order, but it's important, is that we never encountered it before. And so our body has no defense, natural defense, to get rid of it or deal with it. And so what happens is your body will attack it for decades with white blood cells. So if you breathe in an atom, which is 1/10,000 millionth of a meter, think about a meter divided by a million, and then divide one of those 1 millionths by 10,000, and then that's what we're talking about. And so you can't see it or smell it or taste it. It's completely inconspicuous when it's in a drink or water or food or air. And so when you get that in your body floods itself with white blood cells for decades and builds a tumor around it. But at the same time, because cancer is the mouse in the room, cancer is the last one to show up, and that is 1,800 autoimmune deficiencies that will show up before cancer. Alzheimer's, dementia, autism passed on to your children, diabetes, heart, liver, lung, respiratory, pituitary glands, endless cancers that can show up, but also autoimmune deficiencies. And they do. And that is a well-known, well-flushed-out, well-understood part of this, where they studied animals now for 70 years. And we got Dr. Raymond Gilmedy from Loveless Respiratory Research Institute in New Mexico. He killed beagle dogs and beagle puppies with plutonium, americium, and curium. And so a chain reaction, you're not looking for cesium or iodine, even though that's what they do to us. What you should be looking for is curium, and the curium isotopes, which is part of the fissionable products, is produced the most, but it reacts the same way. So you need lead shield 20 times thicker for curium than you do for plutonium. And plutonium was a huge part of what was down there, but curium is produced from the rods after the chain reaction forever. And so that is the big elephant in the room, the big gorilla, 600-pound gorilla on everybody's back, is the fact that no one's looking for curium, because that is the one we should really be worried about, and that is the one we are worried about, and that is the one that devastated the Pacific Ocean and the marine life and the animal life on the coastline of North America. I talk a lot of times in context only as Canada, because I've just done the whole coastline of Canada. And if the ocean doesn't recede the Canadian coastline, then this is emblematic of all the Pacific Rim nations. That's how that works, right? You can't have just one part of the coastline not recede itself, but the rest of it does, because 4 million species would have found their foothold, and when they didn't, it meant they were gone. And the evidence of that, of course, is the mass die-offs of the shrimps, the krill, which is what all the mammals and birds and migratory animals are dependent upon. But that's already well established. These have died off in mass. And that the herring, the anchovies, and the squid, of course, for the birds and the mammals and the whales and sharks and the bigger animals, are extraordinary. They're converting the krill, and the krill was converting phytoplankton. So what we ended up with was a big chain, like an anchor chain for a boat. And we took all these links and we sawed them in two. And then we tried to throw the anchor overboard. And when that didn't work, we threw each piece of the chain over, but the boat still dragged up on the rock because the chain was broken in every way, and there was no way to stop that. And so we're running down a path just like that in the real world. And no one's trying to come up with solutions. There's 2,000 nuclear PR firms trying to spin it and twist it and manipulate it so that people can't have a normal conversation or a debate because they don't want to give it up. The future is dependent upon nuclear technology. If anybody's familiar with Star Wars, it's all lasers. And so the laser technology is well understood. There's a 50-year history of it. There's all kinds of big corporations producing weaponized lasers, and they're dependent upon a massive amount of power. And the only way to make that mobile was isotopes. And because we know a gram produces a raw material is a million watts. And so to produce these high-powered lasers, you're looking at much higher wattages than that. Now, what they were doing in Japan was they were using reclaimed plutonium and uranium. So he took missiles from silos that were left over from the Cold War and reclaimed, say, 40 or 50-year-old, already went through a chain reaction, turned into a nuclear bomb, never got used, now reclaim the uranium, plutonium, and put it through a chain reaction again. Now, by doing that, you already had 2 million tons worse from the chain reaction. Now you have to multiply it by another 2 million. And so several billion times worse than what it was originally. And originally, when it was refined, it was extremely carcinogenic. But now it's volatile. Now a single atom can, say, the curium, you need 20 times lead thicker than you need for plutonium. So when animals are ingesting it and humans are ingesting it, your body is under attack all the time. Your body is constantly, it's destroying the DNA, the chromosomes, it's punching holes in everything there for 20 to 30 years. And so what we got to do is focus in on that we do have an event, and then focus, because that's the only way this is going to work, and then focus all of our institutions in on ways forward. How do we purify water? How are we going to, like, even if we can get rid of some of the stuff out of the water, that's a big move forward for everything left on this planet. And in Canada, George, I'm not sure, Charlotte, and I know I do a lot of talking sometimes, but
it's okay.
In Canada, we have an event going on in our mountains. And now our mountains are full of ice pack, and the ice pack is 1,000 to 10,000 year old hard, thick, solid ice. Yeah, you can hit it with a hammer, you probably can't break a piece off it. And that's like the hearts of the big chunks of ice that's up there. Now, what that done was, that cold water all summer long would come down through the lakes and estuaries and rivers, but it always went down to the coastline also. And so everything on our coastline and all our fish and trout and frogs and bird sanctuaries, on the west side of the Rocky Mountains, were fed cold water all year long. So in a hot summer, you still had this cold water trickling all the way down to the ocean, and that regulated and allowed salmon to get up the river, because you had this, even if you never had rain, you had that flood water coming down from the runoffs from the mountains. But all year long, you know, the snow, you go skiing or skidooing in these mountains. Now, in the last year, that's gone. Every bit of it. It's all gone. And so this year, there was no salmon got up the rivers. This year, if they did make it back. And this year, all the trout failed, right, because the rivers were so hot. And then all the larvae that was used to the regulated temperatures for insects and everything else up the rivers was decimated. Now, my kid, he takes researchers up these rivers looking. He's a guide. He carries a gun. They encounter a lot of cougar and bear and grizzly bears up in these places. And so several weeks ago, he had to put down a bear that was in the river. They were doing a salmon count. And as he was going up the river, I'm sorry, coming back, here was a bear in their way. And normally they scare the bear off with bang sticks and flares and stuff like that. This bear put his head down and started coming towards them. And when he knew that if he didn't knock the bear down now, that bear will be on top of him if he made a mistake and never hit him dead on. And he never done that before. He didn't want to do it. But that bear was emaciated, and there was no salmon in that river. And the bear's scat that they found was apples. And so the berry season failed also because of it was dependent upon all the water coming down, and we had a dry year, a phenomenal year for heat out here like everywhere else. And so this is pure energy. We're going to see massive storms like the Philippines, where there was 30 million coconut trees torn off and turned into projectiles by a storm, a typhoon, that converged at Japan, picked up all of this radioactive material. Because even though you got a gram is a million watts, if you atomize an area of solid, it's still a million watts. Right, it doesn't, and even though it's distributed out, it's still a million watts. It doesn't lose that for its lifetime. And in this case, because it was mixed oxide fuel, which was what we were talking about earlier, where they took reclaimed uranium plutonium, everything that comes out of there is a hot particle. Everything that comes out of there, because a chain reaction is different than everything else combined, these reactors are worse than all the oil spills on the planet, all the plastic that's in the ocean, all the environmental harm that we know about, we can categorize. These reactors, this is a single one, is many times worse than all that combined. Because what a chain reaction is doing is cannibalizing the rocks, is cannibalizing the steel, is cannibalizing, think of a big ball of fire like the sun, inner earth, chewing up everything around it, boring its way down into the earth. But at the same time, we're perpetually pouring water on it. And just by that act alone, we're creating tritium. And this man-made tritium, normally in our water tables, there might be 8 becquerels per cubic meter. In Canada, we now, since Fukushima, have increased it to 7,000 becquerels a cubic meter of man-made isotopes. But natural isotopes in our drinking water are 0.05 of a becquerel, but it disintegrates in 1/10,000th of a second, so you can't get it to your lip, it's gone. It can't cause cancer, it can't mutate a fruit fly. But the stuff from Japan will pulse every second, 1,440 minutes a day, till the end of time, till there is nothing left on the planet. And so the proverbial will, just whatever's left on this planet in the near future, will spend the rest of his life dealing with the nuclear waste that we dumped in the oceans, the lakes, the estuaries, the streams, and buried in landfills is true. And, I mean, we have no choice but to clean up everything we created if we want to have any future in 1,000 years or 100 years or whatever the case may be. And we may not have nothing anyway, but we have to try. That is the human spirit. And when the chips are down, what do? And humans can do incredible feats. And I do believe in my soul that if we were to turn the horsepower that we have on this planet, there is a way for it, but not for the majority of the planet, not for the other 8 million species on the planet. And so right now, we, as a steward of the planet, we have done a deplorable job, not me or you or Charlotte or the people that are standing tall and taking the abuse, but we are rational, we are motivated, we are trying to have a conversation, and we are under attack by 2,000 nuclear PR firms all day, every day, and they don't got many targets. And so the people that are getting any traction at all are going to get pummeled. But you always got to rise above that. It's not about me, and it's not about you. It's about what we can do as the moral compass and ethical responsibility that we are endowed with through. Like, in other words, this is our watch, it's not somebody else's. And
right.
We are that generation, as by proxy what you're doing today with this interview, right? That
right.
Says the whole story, George. Go ahead.
There are people that say, that are engineers and so forth, and we've had one lady on the air, that she believes that the United States has secret technology that could neutralize some of that radioactive material and stuff at the Fukushima plants. Have you heard of such a thing? I know David Urth was at our first conference in Austin, and he headed up investment groups that had solutions to taking, you know, the waste material and making it inert. But the Federal Energy Commission stopped him and his investment groups. But do you believe that we have secret technology that could remediate this Fukushima or not?
No, I don't believe it.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I don't believe it because this stuff is created in the bowels of hell at 6,000-8,000 degree Fahrenheit temperatures.
Yeah.
This stuff, you can put it in a jar of battery acid and you can't hurt it. You can burn it in 3,000 degree incinerators like you're doing in Japan, and all you're doing is liberating it back into the environment. And that everything that I've looked at, and I've looked at a tremendous amount.
Right.
That's why we have the terrorist laws in all countries, and that's why we have the nuclear holding sites. There's no such thing as a waste repository because there is no way to contain this stuff. We have to vent it because of the noble gases. And okay. So if there was a technology, we would have seen a few examples of that.
Yeah.
There would have been some kind of an example that we can cling to or say, hey, that's got possibilities. And I have never seen nothing, but I've heard a lot of claims, and I've looked at just about everything imaginable. And I personally find it hard to believe. I'm not saying it's not true, but I find it hard to believe is my take on it for sure.
Right. Gary Vesperman put together some remediation techniques and possibilities. We have them on FukushimaSolution.com. He's out of Las Vegas, and he's compiled quite a bit over the years. He was deeply into alternative energy and so forth. But so right now in Fukushima, the three plants that have
gone. Let me cut you off 1 second, George.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
I do know one person.
Yeah.
That has explained to me in person to
okay.
him, talking to him, and that he's convinced there is it can help.
Yeah.
Like you can get it, maybe get it out of the water. Or you can get it out of the soil in a way, or you can shift through, or in the case may be. And so I'm just not ruling it out.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, I don't know.
Oh,
but anyway,
okay.
You're talking about Fukushima. Go ahead.
Jim. Yeah. Anyway, right now, the corium masses that were, melting down and, into those buildings, how deep are they below those buildings now? And does anyone really know?
Okay. So they built a power plant on an old, riverbed. The riverbed is what, it's an old riverbed. They call it that because over thousands of years it washed away all the topsoil all the way down to the bedrock.
Right.
And so that's considered an old riverbed. Okay, and so what they built, what they done was they brought in 100 foot of topsoil and they leveled out that whole area, including the river. And so when they built the reactors on top of all of this, this was their backup plan, by the way, of all nuclear power plants. And so what they got done is they build the plants up in the air. The reactor is supposed to go down, melt, and it'll go down through the topsoil like nothing, like butter is gone in 24 hours, literally through the topsoil. So it'll go all the way down, smash into the bedrock. But rocks will consume themselves at around 2,000 degree Fahrenheit temperatures. These are burning 6, 7, 8, 9,000 degree Fahrenheit temperatures. And so this will consume everything as it's going through, and that will come back up through the gap, so to speak, or out into the ocean. So when a power plant, the theory was when a power plant melts down and everybody got to run away because the radiation will strip the hairs from your body right there on the spot, and it'll melt your organs in a few minutes like the Hiroshima women, which is nothing compared to what's in Fukushima, by the way. Okay, and so it melts down, and then the ocean comes in, and that's how they, that's their, oh my goodness plan, is let the ocean or a river flow around and over. But that'll just keep doing what it's going to do till the end of time. So, you know, Elvis has left the building also means that this whole planet has been doomed, right? That's a death sentence for everything on the planet when these things go disappear. And so as far as we know, and I've been advocating this for a long time, of course, is that they've left the building. But now they admit it. Now they don't know where it's all to. Now they got proof and documentation. Now they're starting to roll it out, is that the reactors are all the inventory is gone. So a lot of the fuel pool on the roofs was multiple reactors, and the reactors hold 5 million pounds each. And so they have to put it on the roof and keep it there for several years, even decades, until it cools down. But at the same time, it's boiling off 120,000 liters in each pool every day of curium and isotopes and plutonium, uranium, americium, neptunium. The real bad stuff is being mixed with water and released into the community as steam. And also, I'm just going to jump for a second. In Leningrad,
I wanted to bring that up. That's just a recent accident there. Right outside of St. Petersburg, less than a week ago, there was an accident at the Leningrad nuclear power plant. Go ahead, continue with that.
Okay, so this power plant has been under my radar for quite a long time.
Sure.
Now, when they built it, they opened the doors on it, it had an accident. And they said there was no reported victims or there was no radiation releases. Now, Unit 1 exploded there. But a month later, they had a rupture in the same reactor. So they were covering it up. But this time, 3 people were killed. And that's 1975. Also in 1975, they had the same type of accident as Chernobyl. Now, Chernobyl stopped after 10 days. The chain reaction did. That's why they got a sarcophagus over Chernobyl. But what happened in Leningrad was it didn't stop for over a month that they admit to. So this was worse than Chernobyl. But Chernobyl, anybody's not familiar with that, in the comparison of what, and I'll keep on going on Leningrad, but Chernobyl was one-third the size of any reactors in Japan. Chernobyl was a 30% meltdown. Chernobyl was equal to 400 Hiroshima bombs after 10 days. Now, if it lasted 20 days, that's 800 Hiroshima bombs. If it lasted 30 days, 1,200 Hiroshima bombs, 40 days, etc. And that's what happened at Leningrad back in 75. But Chernobyl, they admitted it. And so Chernobyl, you can't eat the meat or drink the milk or sell the land in parts of Ireland, Scotland, UK, and that even today, and that in Sweden, a couple of years ago, they just started the freshwater fishing industries after 26 years of being banned because of Chernobyl. But Chernobyl, in comparison, is just a candlestick compared to Fukushima. So back to Leningrad. Leningrad, they were using graphite fuel and helium. And so did you hear a few years ago where the scientists were saying there's a shortage of helium? That was a lie. they were hoarding it for their reactors, and because they can make some wicked isotopes. But what they were doing in Leningrad is different than Fukushima. They were using the same as Chernobylers using graphite. And graphite can catch fire when it's in contact with oxygen. And so so if you boil your kettle, does your house fill up with steam? No. Because the steam dissipates. Yeah, it did fill up with steam if you look at your windows, but your house is not full of steam. You can see the stove. And so what came out of the reactor in Leningrad a few days ago, they said is steam. They call it radioactive steam, by the way, but they said it was steam. Now, steam, once you get so far away, it dissipates. It doesn't get thicker and bigger and cover an obscure land, right? It dissipates very quickly. That's not what happened in Leningrad. Leningrad, the plume I seen was over a half mile long, and it still poured out. Now, if you look at the model from Leningrad, and I've been looking at this stuff, of course, the model goes all the way over to Helsinki. It's a straight line of radioactive fallout. So right across that ocean, all the way over to Finland. Now, because this plant in 1976 and 79, they had fires in the waste repository that, and it's not a repository, it's just a holding site. By proxy, all nuclear power plants keep their used fuel on the site. And once again, a pound of it can kill everybody in 20 minutes and 1,500 people at a time, till the end of time. And so they lost a whole bunch of fuel rods. And a number of times in 1990, when they were trying to refurbish what they say was Unit 1, they were hoping the radiation levels had dropped. And so how many people were sacrificed the one they're doing that one? But they went in there, and what they discovered was the graphite was disappearing. And so they had to evacuate that whole area again. But what that also mean was that since 75 all the way up to Den for sure, there was a huge release from there. And that's why the public, the locals were the way they were. That's why they panicked. That's why they all tried to run away, because they knew the history, like I'm talking about right now. In 91, they had 10 fuel rods that were dropped and damaged. 96, they had 360 liters a day was hemorrhaging out that they admit to. Now, see, any time that they admit to something is because they have to cover up what's really going on. So they knew that everybody was aware there was a leak, liquid coming out of there. So they said, they spun the wheel of fortune, got 360, and they said 360 liters. So, okay, let's go to present day.
Oh, there was one thing, a point I want to make here.
Go ahead.
I picked up on an article, Charles Diggs, and he said in October, the article published October 9, 2015, he says that there was a seaweed obstruction on the intake for the cooling for those, Leningrad, nuclear power plant.
So they need 1 million gallons a minute.
So, but the article and the information that the Russians released was not consistent with the structure of the intakes, according to this article. So
wow.
there was some puffing or leaving out or whatever. Even the press release.
They blamed it on seaweed.
But bottom sediments, the storm blew, says bay bottom sediments into the plant's intake structures, clogging the intakes that supply water to the unit's cooling system.
They have grinders that are like wood chippers.
Yeah.
So if anything does come in, it gets grinded up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so it's really interesting they would say that. Go ahead. I'm sorry, George.
But anyway, it's interesting that an event like that would occur a little over a month ago. See, and now we have this additional. So there was
right.
problems. We don't know exactly right. the details, see, that occurred in October. We know
okay.
there was an event
well, you
there.
Can extrapolate. That, you can
yeah,
extrapolate.
Right. We can extrapolate and move it forward in time to the present date. See what I mean?
Right. And so what okay, happened was, I'm glad you brought that up, by the way. And what
yeah.
happened was a month ago they had that issue.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what it needs 1 million gallons a minute. Now, if it don't get 1 million gallons a minute for 90 minutes, it starts to melt down. Once it starts to melt down, they weren't using neutron rods because it's graphite. But once it starts to melt, because that would normally be how you try to control it, you wouldn't be able to get it in there like Japan. That's what happened in Japan. They couldn't get the rods in once it started to melt down. Not that they tried. But in Leningrad, once it starts melting down, it gets a breach. Now oxygen gets in there and you have a detonation. It continues to melt down. And so they have to cover why they can't get it to to run or why this is wrong or that's wrong or why you can't fix it. So all of a sudden they say, we had an event, we had a release, and that buys them time, right, to keep it buried for a little bit longer, to hide it away for a little tiny bit longer. Meanwhile, what I'm seeing is a meltdown and a melt through, most likely, of the fuel rods that they were using, not the fuel rods, but the graphite that they were using.
Okay.
Because of the volume of smoke that we saw coming out of there and the fact that they alluded there was radioactive steam. But radioactive steam, in order to have radioactive steam, would mean you would have to break the pipe, the first containment pipes, because that's radiated water. And so that stuff is coming in contact with the fissionable products. And yeah. So if that was the case, then they definitely, which it seems like it is, that's what they seem to be, everything is being pointed towards. So they had a major event. But once again, like I say, I just read the history in 2005, 2000, and 2009, and 2015, Unit 2 was stopped. That's that one right now.
Okay.
But you got that, you got all the way from 75 to now, accident after accident after accident. Every single time, the media wasn't informed, the locals weren't informed. In 1975, when they had that massive release, the people in the Baltic weren't even informed. And these things are built right on the ocean, and they just have this culture of impunity, and so they lie. But, of course, the repercussions take 5, 10, usually 15 years to show up. And so by that time, they're moved on, they're died, and they don't even care. That is a huge issue, see, because it's been going on for so long, there's no one to hold them accountable even right now. Now they're still at their lying, saying there was no radioactive releases. Meanwhile, radioactive steam got out, but it didn't increase the background level. So background level got nothing to do with man-made stuff. A single atom from man-made is a guaranteed cancer. It sequesters in your organs, it sequesters in your muscles, it sequesters in your bones. And once it's there, it's not going away, and it's going to perpetually pulse. Your body's going to respond to it. Every pulse and send out more white blood cells. White blood cells are going to displace the oxygen molecules in your blood, and you're going to feel weak. You're going to feel sick. It's going to change the pH of your body. It's going to allow diseases and pathogens and viruses to get a stranglehold and a foothold in places where they shouldn't be. And then you'll have adverse side effects. And once again, 1,800 autoimmune deficiencies now will manifest.
Right.
That's how it plays out in animals. And go ahead, George.
Charlotte, do you have any comments there?
I feel like a canary in the coal mine.
I know. It is so overwhelmingly the event in Fukushima and these other events. They're all coming together. And I think what's important, too, was Dana Dunford was talking about the coastline of British Columbia, and there's a food chain that had a major interruption, a disruption. And when you start interrupting the food chain from the plankton on up, then you've got major problems, and that's exactly what's happened out there, hadn't it, in the Pacific?
Right, and it takes just a couple of years for that to manifest, too, once the damage is done. And so now that the damage was done, we see those manifestations. And they're frightening. They're unbelievable. They're accelerating. But they can't. At some point, we're going to run out of creatures to report on. And that's what's happening on the coastline of British Columbia. There was another whale 2 days ago, a washed up, a baby killer whale here. First one that ever washed up in the Campbell River area. Someone went down and chopped the head off it. Nobody knows who done it or why they done it. But somebody went down and chopped the head off it anyway. I was going to run over and have a look, but it's Christmas Eve, and I haven't stopped. You know, I haven't stopped in the last 2 years. I haven't had a day off in the last 2 years.
You know those photographs of you out there bucking those waves, and there were pretty bad waves at times, weren't there? You were buffeting up and down and going right through and on that inflatable boat that you have. I can't do anything but admire you for all these surveys and it was a tough go, wasn't it?
We had to do it. It had to get done, and we couldn't trust anybody else because I put it up at my website. So bottom line is.
Now, yeah. Some of the people along the coast there that you interviewed, I recall an interview with someone that headed up one of those centers along the coast. They were not very friendly because
Berkeley Sound.
Yeah, they did not want to really come clean on the real danger, did they? Of the
I stuck it to them really good over and over and over and over.
Yeah,
they gave me a different answer each time.
I know.
Yeah, they gave me a different answer every time for the same question. But I let him switch gears, and then a minute later, 2 minutes later, I come back. Where's the white, giant white sea anemones? The giant white plume sea anemones. And what they are, about 3 foot sea anemones.
Right.
And they, well, if you took a sea anemone and chopped it up into 500 pieces and threw it on a beach, you got 500 sea anemones. And so if you've got a storm, you get up to 500 of them in a square meter. And so when you get a storm tossing all these rocks around, they get squat up and there's more there in another couple of months.
Right.
And so, yeah. And so they proliferate, and they are the very, you know, they are the very epitome of British Columbia coastline.
I see. And when they weren't there, they were missing. And of course, with all your diving experience and your
14,000 hours,
right? You've been there. You've seen all of this sea life, and the absence of it now is overwhelming to you. And that's what the photographic evidence that you were putting up on your site was saying.
Right, you can't beat the photos, see? And the GPS. And that's we're to the wireless, untouched, no industry anywhere. And then we even done the West Coast, the open West Coast. I don't think many people can understand why I say it that way, but the big waves, yeah. We've done thousands and thousands of dollars worth of damage to the boat, went in, repaired, and hit straight back out again. Like I said, I have not stopped in 2 years. I have no rest, no breaks, and I have to crowdfund everything.
Well, we have your click-offs up there. And we're going to, of course, request all the donations that we can give you for our audience to start sending you some money up there, too, because it's taken thousands of dollars just to get out there and do these things.
I'm not going to venture to say because I haven't really done the numbers.
Right.
But it's well over 100,000 to pull off what we pulled off.
Right.
And, the 15,000 miles of coastline tells that story 100%.
Sure.
No one can deny it. And I want everybody to understand that the stuff that we got is free for everybody. Anybody can take the stuff at my site and make documentaries with it and tell that story.
Right.
That's the point of it. Yeah.
It's the nuclear proctologist.
It's free.
.org. And we have
right.
that click off up there on our site also. And Charlotte, did you want to add anything in?
No, gentlemen, I really don't. This has been,
what Dana has done is so overwhelmingly, my gosh, it's just a sacrifice. It's a labor of love for humankind, your fellow mankind. You know that?
It ain't gonna stop. I'm 24/7.
And
I live, eat, breathe this because I understand that. I have an opportunity to teach everybody a real narrative and give this whole planet that opportunity.
Now let me ask you this. What we've been pushing, we had, in 2014, we had two conferences. I got so scared after the first one, we held a second one the same year. But I wanted to call initially, way back 3 years ago, I wanted to call for an international conference, and I contacted several of very important politicos here. But would an international conference be helpful or not?
Yes.
Huh?
Yes, it would. Absolutely, 100%.
Because it's going to take a world solution to address this. It's not just a Japanese problem anymore. Japanese, no. North Pacific, British Columbia, Alaska,
we're all in
Canada.
The same boat.
Then the currents eventually will take all of this radioactivity around the world, won't it not? Will it not?
Well, yeah. And so it's released into the atmosphere. So it works this way that the jet stream circle the planet air currents, the jet streams help get it there, in about 40 days. Now, once it goes into the upper and lower troposphere, it takes about 10 years to rain out if it was just a single, like, detonation from a bomb.
Okay.
It would take about 10 years to rain out. And so we're talking about extraordinary numbers. So
right.
a gram of it produces more atoms, radioactive atoms, than every grain of sand on all the beaches on the planet combined. So what is millions and millions and millions and millions of pounds going to produce? It's going to produce, an invisible snowstorm. And that stuff is being liberated from the ocean in tens of thousands of miles on top of that every day in rain and clouds and when the typhoons and hurricane and fog. And think about how it's liberated. Oxygen and salt is liberated from the ocean originally, say, from crashing into our coastline. Okay,
right.
And so what they done was studies on this, and they showed that insects up to 200 miles inshore of the coastline were acclimated to more salt in their diet. They were the same insects as the rest of the country, but they were able to deal with more salt. They were more higher tolerant for it. And so radionucleoids are liberated to that same venue, to that same vector. And so people got to consider that, is that by rights, everybody has to be 200 miles minimum inland to even try to mitigate it. But on the flip side of it, everything that's coming in on the Pacific coastlines in Canada from North America is hitting the Rocky Mountains first. The clouds are heavy with moisture. And not all of them, but a lot of them will hit the Rocky Mountains and they'll lose a lot of their payloads. That washes back down towards the coastline and the cycle never stops. And so the reality of it is what we're going to find out in the near future is we got to get on the other side of the Rocky Mountains.
Right, right.
Say per se, you know.
One point also, the greatest oxygen producers, I understand it, are the microbes floating on the ocean surface. Yeah. Now,
phytoplankton.
Yeah, right. Then that is being affected also, right?
So they're the biggest production of oxygen. They're the biggest carbon sequesters on the planet.
Yes.
And they're the very basis of the food chain itself. And so originally radiation, you could find it through bioaccumulation in phytoplankton. They would look for it in phytoplankton. But that was small amounts. What's coming out of Japan is incredible. Now, I know this is probably, I'm not sure if you're aware of this. So the earthquake traveled through at 9,000 miles per hour. It was felt in Florida 30 minutes. It shook the country for 6 minutes.
Okay.
And there was hundreds of aftershocks that day.
Right.
And so everything that was falling in on top of the melted reactors was atomizing and aerosoling during each of these tremors. And every year there's thousands of tremors in Japan.
Right.
So every year there's thousands of different opportunities for stuff to fall down there and come up as vapor or smoke or steam or whatever you want to call it. But it's radioactive atoms.
Sure.
And so as that keeps continuing to happen forever, as that continued to happen for the first year, now look at a snowstorm that you're driving down the road in, and you can't see the car ahead of you very well.
Okay.
But that's because you can see snow. But that's, now think about that snowstorm in the ocean.
Right.
Now think about how snow would normally hit the ocean and would turn to water, but this doesn't. It's an isotope. So think about the ocean as an invisible snowstorm. So everything is surrounded in an invisible snowstorm, and these things are pulsing every second. Now, at the same time, it's heating the ocean up by about 7 degrees. So it's changing the pHs of the ocean. It's changing the level of the ocean, the temperature rather of the ocean, salinity of the ocean. And so the phytoplankton are in that vulnerable zone where the snowstorm is originally hitting the surface and falling its way down through. But phytoplankton are fed by the cold nutrients, the cold water that brings the nutrients from down deep on the ocean floor from the sediments of all the life that died. It brings that back up. But because the radionucleoids are even smaller than that stuff, than the nutrients that we're talking about, that also comes back up too. And so the phytoplankton are constantly being exposed, and they got eradicated. They become so toxic in themselves because the phytoplankton is so tiny, and this stuff is so powerful, it can pound out like 12 inches with pulses. And so that would I can call it like popcorn.
Yeah.
So you put a phytoplankton in a soup of radioactive materials like popcorn, they all just pop, 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 and they're gone. That seems to be what happened here because it didn't stop falling out. So the phytoplankton never got a break, right?
Right.
So if you're in a house full of smoke and you can find a window and get some fresh air, but it's not big enough to crawl out, that's enough for you to get fresh air. Now go look for another way out. But if you can't find that window to get the fresh air and you can't find your way out, you're going to choke to death. And that's what's happening to the phytoplankton, where they can't get a break. They can't find a spot where they can reproduce or they can feed properly, or that's conducive of their normal habitat, because it's all been, and we strip out everything else at the same time around them that they're dependent upon, because the zooplanktons and everything else are in that same. So think about phytoplankton as oyster. So an oyster shellfish would lay 11 million eggs, 11 million. And a cod would lay, say, 700,000. But those eggs are considered phytoplankton. So phytoplankton is not just plants. It's also a little marine life. And it's what I call a soup of life. And so a glass of salt water would normally have 75 to 100 million phytoplankton and a billion other creatures. But those billion other creatures are also gone now, too, see? Right. And that's why everything is dying. That's why everything is falling apart. There are going to be patches out there, but I didn't find any patches on the coastline. I found 100 species, and none of them were in good shape. All of them were desperate. None of them were large adults. All of them were lethargic, almost petrified in many senses. And then all the normal indigenous species were completely missing, and the other 4 million didn't receive the coastline. So all of these, when you added them up,
right,
and the fact that this is not going to stop anytime soon, because we only send in the homeless, we send in the people that don't speak the language, the immigrants, and we don't see Harvard or Yale or Stanford or MIT or Oxford has ever went there a single time, but yet they all went to Chernobyl.
Right,
they all
right.
went to 3 mile alarm. Yeah, but none of them went to Fukushima. How come?
There's been a blackout on it, yeah.
None of them went to Fukushima because it's so toxic.
I got
it. It's so bad,
yeah. Yeah. We've got about 3 minutes left. How about some concluding remarks, Dana Dunford?
I just wanted to thank Dana tremendously from the bottom of my heart for what you're doing for humanity and the larger, you know, population out here. This is definitely a difficult time to be human on this planet. I do have a question though. What about I understand that you said that all the living things were dead. Has anybody tried mycelia or mushrooms or anything along the fungi or in that capacity for remediation?
That's a good one because we know they aggregate it, right? We know mushrooms really truly aggregate radiation. And we do know a lot of stuff out there that aggregates it. But unfortunately, this is way beyond anything imaginable. That would be appropriate for, like, farms, appropriate for, like, animals, where you got animals and stuff like that to suck up radiation and find a way to dispose of it is a whole different story. But nevertheless, that's a way to remediate it. I do agree there are a way to try to clean up soil and stuff like that, suck this stuff out with natural stuff, and then try to use the soil. 100%, Charlotte. That's a brilliant idea.
Well, you know, Dana, something just came to me. Instead of going over to Paris like they did, we need to marshal the world's resources around this new industry of addressing the Fukushima events.
Yes, thank you.
You see what I mean? And you're a big part of that, and I think Charlotte has contributed a great deal, too, in this program. I told her earlier, I said, we're going to give America and the world a special Christmas present by interviewing Dana Dunford. You know what I mean? We've got to tell it like it is. I'm sorry.
That's what I do.
You know, we've got to put it out there because it's a major problem.
It's the moral thing to do. Thank you.
It's an earth killer. I mean, that's the problem with this thing.
It's
an extinction event. We've got to start facing that fact because it's so overwhelmingly,
it's proven now.
You've proved it up in the lagoons and all of that other good stuff. So, and we're trying to bring out the most cogent, terms here and topics that I could think of, you know. But, we want to thank you so very much for all the hard work you've done. I think, Charlotte, you feel the same way, don't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you, folks. No, you guys don't stop either. I know.
And we're going to get out there and continue to publicize this. And let's work towards an international world conference. What do you think? Huh?
Absolutely.
And creating an industry. Maybe that's what Canada needs to do. Take their fishing industries and turn them into, clean up along that west coast. See what I mean?
Well,
and pour money into it. But take world resources.
Right.
Where Canada. Canada may not be able to afford it nationwide, but worldwide we can afford it. We want to thank you so very much, Dana Dunford, for being with
us and all the
sacrifices and contributions you made. So thank you very much and good night.
Yeah, hugs for everybody. Take care, folks.
Okay, good night.